Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm Jordan Stefaniak, one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my friend Joel Chopp. And we are excited to be here today on a podcast or YouTube show that is all about serious thinking for a serious church. And when we talk about serious thinking, we try to explain that by things like an intellectual culture of things of charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. And today I'm thrilled to have with me Dr. Taylor Sear and Dr. Matthews Grant to be talking about all things determinism and libertarian free will and all the fun that goes in between those things. So before we get started, Taylor is assistant professor of philosophy at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And then Matthews Grant is professor of philosophy at St. Thomas University, which I think is in Minneapolis?
St. Paul, Minnesota.
St. Paul. That was my second guess. Yeah, I was close. I should have had it down. Anyway, in the very cold state of Minnesota, that's what I know. You guys are polar opposites in weather. And Joel is, you're something with Wheaton College. I should have gotten that down too.
Yeah. So next year I'll be visiting assistant professor of theology at Wheaton College for a year.
So I am outmanned and outgunned in this conversation by a long margin. I am here just to ask all of the questions that the five-year-olds of us need help with. So let's go ahead and get started. Taylor, maybe you just set the table a little bit for me on determinism. I know you've written a lot on that. Explain what that is, maybe some misconceptions that would be commonly had by those who are watching stuff on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of different things people mean by determinism. So most philosophers working today who talk about determinism use the term just to refer to the thesis that given some state of the world at some time and given laws of nature, there's only one way the future can unfold from that time. So maybe it's the distant past, and with deterministic laws of nature, there's only one physically possible future. So it seems like if determinism's true, everything's already in the cards, so to speak. Whatever will be, will be. Although maybe this is one of the places where it's helpful to kind of correct a misconception. A lot of people conflate determinism with a kind of fatalism, where there's only one possible future in a stronger sense, maybe only one, given sort of the facts of logic, there's only one way that things can go. But usually when people are talking about determinism in philosophy, it's causal or physical determinism that they're interested in, and they're interested in the laws of nature in particular. But another thing that might come up in our conversation is something like divine determinism or theological determinism, where we have not the laws of nature necessarily playing the role of determining the future, but something about God. So maybe it's God's intentions or God's decrees, but something about God makes one future possible. We could fill that out in different ways, and it turns out I haven't found a standard way of spelling out divine determinism in the literature. It gets worked out in a few different ways. But the idea is roughly the same. Given maybe God's decrees or God's intentions or plans, there's only one possible way that the future can unfold, like holding that fact about God fixed.
Cool. Matthews, I don't know if you want to give any potential nuances to how you think of determinism, but if you don't have anything that you would say, I'd massage that in a particular way. Talk to me a little bit about libertarian free will and maybe some of the ways that that could be confused or misunderstood.
Yeah, I mean, I think Taylor's account of determinism sounds good. This is not so much necessarily an alternative to it, but another way of thinking about it maybe that I like, in part because it would capture a variety of different sorts of determinism. If you start off thinking about what it would be for an event to be determined, you might say that an event is determined if there is some factor that is prior to that event. It could be temporally prior, or maybe more importantly, something like causally or explanatorily prior. So if there's some factor prior to the event, and that factor in some sense necessitates the event so that it's not possible for that factor to hold or occur, obtain, without the events obtaining, then we might say that that event is determined. And then, if all events were determined, you'd have sort of a very widespread, global determinism. So whether that's determinism by prior events in the laws of nature, or whether it's determinism by divine decrees, one way or the other, you'd still get determinism. But yeah, that, and I think that fits more or less with what Taylor was saying. He's certainly right that I think when most philosophers are talking about determinism, they're thinking of it in terms of prior points in time and laws of nature. Should I continue to talk about libertarianism
ahead.
Then? Or, So, I mean, libertarianism is just a name that is given to describe a particular view or family of views about a free will. And maybe a prior term to be introduced is incompatibilism or compatibilism. So there's a question about whether or not free will, free action, free choices, you could say it in various ways, whether or not free action is compatible with determinism. And compatibilists are those who say that free will and determinism are compatible, and incompatibilists say that they're not compatible. Okay, once you've got incompatibilism, you've got people who think that it's free will and determinism are incompatible. There are a couple of different ways you could go. You could affirm determinism, in which case you would have to deny that anyone has free will. Or you could affirm free will, in which case you'd be committed to rejecting determinism. Well, libertarians are incompatibilists. They think free will and determinism are incompatible. They're incompatibilists who affirm free will and therefore are committed to rejecting determinism. I suppose there are some who are incompatibilists who affirm determinism and therefore reject free will. The compatibilists, nice thing maybe about being a compatibilist is it doesn't really matter whether determinism turns out to be right or not. You could still affirm free will. So that would be the compatibilist side.
Interesting. So, Taylor, would you disagree with any of that at all, or are you on the page with that? Okay.
The only thing I'd add is that there are also people that are just skeptical that we have free will, whether determinism's true or not, which fits with what Matthews was just saying.
Okay. So, are you just, Taylor, you're a compatibilist, right? And Matthews, that's right. Would you consider yourself a compatibilist or not?
I don't think so. Although I'm not, I would say I have libertarian intuitions, but then I want to affirm a whole bunch of things, especially in the realm of theology, that most people think you have to be a compatibilist to affirm if you want to hold free will. And I want to try to square those with my libertarian intuitions. So I say I have libertarian intuitions, I can't say that I have, there's just been so much written on this, and I can't say that I have, read thoroughly all the best, compatibilist responses to arguments for incompatibilism and so forth. And so, I'm open to being, to being convinced that compatibilism is a plausible view, but my intuitions are libertarian.
I remember I was a student of Greg Welty's at the time. I think your book came out on the dual source account. Mm-hmm. And I think he was reviewing it for maybe Phil Christie or something like that. And he was like, he was like halfway through and he's like, I don't know where it goes wrong yet, but I know it does.
Yeah. Well, I think most philosophers find themselves in that position at some point. This can't be right, but they're not sure where it goes wrong. So,
So I think following up on that, and that this is probably first to Matthews, because you have a more complicated story to tell, and then Taylor as well. Can an action be caused by God and also free?
I want to say that it can, and I would think that, it might be easier to say why it can for a compatibilist, although I I stand, you know, well, stand corrected on that. But I think it's harder to explain how an action could be caused by God and be free for a libertarian. But that's what I, you know, want to argue. Yeah, I think God could bring about our acts and they still be free in a libertarian sense. And the main reason for that, we can talk more about details if you wanted, but the main reason for that is I think God's causing our actions or bringing about our actions doesn't introduce the sort of factor that I was talking about earlier that would determine them. In other words, it doesn't introduce a factor that is both sort of causally or explanatorily prior to our act and which necessitates our act or is such that it's not possible for that factor to hold and the act not follow. Yeah.
Taylor, is that just an easy yes?
It is an easy yes. Yeah, as a compatibilist, I can say God causes our actions, our choices, and that, they can still be free. Now, I guess I might actually have some kind of libertarian intuitions too, like Matthew's does, in that I think God's determining everything, or even our actions being determined by prior states of the world and the laws of nature, I do think that calls into question whether we're able to avoid doing what we actually do, or whether we can do anything that we avoid that we don't actually do. I tend to think, this is why I get labeled a semi-compatibilist, I tend to think determinism does preclude the freedom to do otherwise. I just am the kind of compatibilist who thinks we don't need that kind of freedom to have a freedom worth wanting, the freedom that's required for moral agency, moral accountability, these sorts of things. So I guess I'm okay with saying, even if God causing our actions makes it so that they're inevitable for us and we can't avoid doing what we do, I still don't think that would be a problem for our freedom in this sense.
So I tend to, personally, I think I have intuition, or at least the way I cash it out is probably like Taylor. And I imagine, Joel, you're probably closer to what Matthews is describing here. So I'm curious about how you, like, where are the pain points you would say, I feel struggles with how Taylor would explain it, or I feel struggles with how Matthews would explain it, and here's why.
And so did you, which one, should I start?
Or you know, one? That's a good question. Taylor, why don't you take the first stab at it?
It depends how we spell out the account. I guess for me, it's the simple answer that the compatibilist can give to this question is a selling point. And so long as there aren't decisive problems for the kind of compatibilist view that I didn't even really sketch, I gestured at really in passing. As long as there aren't decisive problems for that, I think it's a safe position to be in. And it has the advantage that Matthews mentioned earlier, that like it doesn't matter whether causal determinism is true or false, and it allows for a kind of divine determinism where you get a really robust account of providence to fit with the view of freedom. And I don't have any stronger sort of anti-compatibilist intuition or any convincing anti-compatibilist argument that sort of sways me out of that starting point.
Yeah, and so, I mean, if I have any concerns about the kind of picture Taylor is presenting, it's just, I suppose, whether or not it's consistent with moral responsibility. So, I mean, on the surface, and I should say, I don't necessarily think that for absolutely any act I perform, I could only be morally responsible for that act if I could have done otherwise. But, you know, it's a pretty good excuse unless you've got a lot more to say. You know, if somebody is accused of something and it turns out that they couldn't have done otherwise than they did, on the surface of it, that seems like a pretty good reason to say that they're not blameworthy for what they've done. You know, if I'm a defense attorney and I can prove that my client who's charged with some crime couldn't have done otherwise, you know, then that that seems to, all things being equal, suggest that he's maybe not really guilty. So part of it, I guess the question I might have for Taylor or other compatibilists is, you know, how do they massage that push those kinds of intuitions aside?
Yeah. Right. And I tend to agree that that excuse is good in general. And so the question is, what would be different in the case of, say, divine determinism taking away alternative possibilities in every case that would somehow leave room for at least some of the time for us to perform free actions? And I think, and this is really going back to Harry Frankfurt's classic paper from 1969 on alternate possibilities and moral responsibility and the kind of compatibilist view motivated by that project. But if the reason why the defendant didn't do otherwise is because they couldn't have done otherwise, that's when, like Frankfurt, I think there's a really good excuse. But if it wasn't part of the explanation for why the agent did what they did that they couldn't have done otherwise, then I think, especially if it's not part of what they're aware of or what reasons come to mind for them, or these sorts of like epistemic alternatives, if the agent's not thinking that they can't do otherwise, it seems to me that it'd be kind of odd to use the lack of alternative possibilities as a sort of defense.
I may get the details of this wrong, but and I it's maybe bad for me to confess to have seen this movie and probably more than once. But have you seen the movie Zoolander?
Oh yes.
There was a time when I could use this example in class, and you know students would know what I'm talking about. And I think we've now passed that. But you know, there's a point, and spoiler alert, right, where I think Zoolander has been like, I don't know, right. I don't know, he's sort of hypnotized, some sort of hypnosis or something weird's going on, you know, that is going to cause him to assassinate the prime minister of Malaysia or something like this. I couldn't tell you the context for a while. That is matters.
That's pretty good.
If I tried, you know, and I think, you know, eventually, of course, the plot and the plan is foiled. But I'm just thinking, all right, Zoolander's not... I think it's, you know, he has presumably reasons for doing what he thinks he's got reasons for doing what he's doing. He's not aware that what he's doing is inevitable given the prior circumstances. And it seems like if he had gone through with it or been able to go through with it, I don't know. I'm inclined to think, you know, he shouldn't go to jail like the ones who, you know, maybe who hypnotized him should go to jail. So anyway, I don't know what you would say, Taylor, to that. Is there?
Right. I mean, I do think the sort of manipulation, you know, the family of objections that have to do with manipulation, and I think that is the strongest kind of objection to this sort of compatibilist view. I think if it's just that he's being controlled and he's not actually kind of thinking about what to do or just, you know, reasoning about what to do, he's just a mere puppet, that he's off the hook entirely. Is it because he couldn't have done otherwise? It might be because he doesn't satisfy other kind of typical compatibilist conditions on freedom. Like, you know, it might not be that he's doing what he has a, you know, second order desire to do and that sort of thing. So, I mean, depending on how you spell out the compatibilist view, but you know, you tinker with the case enough and you get a case where someone is like an intrinsic duplicate of me, but they were created a minute ago, or they were brainwashed into having the kind of character that I have, and then they go and do the same thing as me. Are they morally responsible? I think this is where you start to see some of the costs of my compatibilist position. I do ultimately think, yes, if you spell out the case just right and you make the person an intrinsic duplicate of someone else who is fully morally responsible, that they've got to be morally responsible. But I do feel the pull of the kind of countervailing intuition here, and I tell a longer story in some of my work about how degrees of responsibility might come to help in the compatibilist here. But that's maybe a rabbit trail we don't want to go down.
So I'm filing away the Zoolander gambit as one of the manipulation arguments to use in the future. I love that. Taylor, I'm curious if you could spell out a little bit. So for quite a while in the literature, the main distinctions were, you know, libertarian and compatibilist. Those are the folks that affirm free will. But more recently, there's been another distinction that carves up the territory a little bit differently, sourcehood and leeway. So could you just tell us a little bit about, you know, those distinctions and how they kind of cut across that, those are the other categories.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you introduced those terms, leeway and sourcehood, because I've kind of been hinting at that distinction and the difference between my compatibilist view and another one without naming the views. So if you think that what's really most important for free will, and people spell this out in different ways, but if you think what's most important is, or at least centrally important, is that we need alternative possibilities or the ability to do otherwise to really be free, then you're thinking in terms of the leeway conception of freedom, where freedom is a matter of having genuinely available alternative possibilities, and we call that leeway. The other type of view, sourcehood views, it's not always clear that they don't require alternative possibilities. It sometimes depends on the details, but they often emphasize that what's centrally important for free will is that the agent is the appropriate source of their behavior, their action. And they don't always emphasize, and sometimes they say they don't require the ability to do otherwise or the freedom to do otherwise, what I called earlier, leeway freedom. So yeah, my view is a source compatibilist view, and I think that's the kind of view that Frankfurt made popular in the contemporary literature. There are compatibilists who are leeway compatibilists who disagree with Frankfurt and think, no, you really do have to have the ability to do otherwise to have free will. They just think, and this is where I have more libertarian sounding intuitions, they just think leeway freedom is compatible with determinism. Excuse me, sorry about this. You mentioned that this sort of cuts across the compatibilist and the libertarian pro-free will views. There are leeway libertarians and sourcehood libertarians. It's less clear to me among libertarians, and maybe Matthews, you have thoughts on this too. It's less clear to me how you could be a sort of thoroughgoing sourcehood libertarian. I have worries that you've got to think that there's some kind of relevance of indeterminacy to leeway or alternative possibilities, but there are some who claim to be sourcehood libertarians, and so the leeway versus sourcehood distinction cuts across the compatibilist libertarian divide.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is, and again, I don't know that I am acquainted with all the different, you know, variations of these views, but the sourcehood libertarians that I'm familiar with usually, I think, acknowledge or say that you've got to have alternative possibilities at some point in the history of a kind of action for which one's morally responsible. So maybe in any, you know, a given action, maybe for example, it's so part of your character. For example, maybe you've got such a your character of being honest is so strong that it's really not, you know, possible for you in a particular set of circumstances, you know, to tell a lie for some, you know, trivial reason. Okay, that would be contrary to your character. So you don't have the ability to do otherwise. But they would say, but you're morally responsible for and praiseworthy for telling that truth, even though you couldn't have lied. But that's only because it's ultimately your character is traced back to some, you know, a prior action of honesty where you really could have done otherwise. You told the lie, but you could have told the lie, but you told the truth instead. You did that a number of times when you could have done otherwise that built up this character from which inevitably you're going to tell the truth. So they would, I think, describe themselves as sourcehood libertarians, but they're committed, I think, to at least sometimes agents having the ability to do otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your sense, Taylor, that that's
Yeah, I think that's more popular than a sort of a more pure sourcehood libertarian view. And
Joel, I can't imagine you're exercising any free will in the fact that you're drinking LaCroix right now. I just have to mention that. Actual related question. So, Matthews, you talk about, I guess, God's universal causality. Does that preclude libertarian free will? Because my gut intuition is a significant amount of our watchers or listeners who identify as some reformed-ish area are going to think that you can't have both of those things together.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people think you can't have both of them together. That's, I think, the prevailing view. I think you can, you know, because I think if, you know, as I was saying earlier, if an act caused by God can be free in the libertarian sense, then it seems like all of our acts could be caused by God and be free in a libertarian sense. And so that's what I argue. Which, I mean, would probably, I would think, to, would be welcome news to people in the Reformed tradition who, you know, want to maintain these strong accounts of God's providence, grace, predestination. And maybe they're comfortable with compatibilism, but if you can hold, you know, hold all those theological, affirm all those theological doctrines you want to affirm, even if compatibilism turns out to be false, you know, maybe all the better in terms of strengthening that, the theological side. So I don't know. But yeah, I think to, yes, I think they are, not to complicate that, they're compatible, libertarian free, freedom, and divine universal causality. Yeah, consistent.
Yeah, so this is first a question for Taylor, but I was curious about, it follows on what Matthews was just saying, your compatibilism, how do you view its relationship to kind of Reformed theological commitments? Do you think, do you see compatibilism as required by kind of Reformed theological commitments, or implied, or consistent with?
That's a good question. I don't know at the end of the day. I definitely think consistent with. Do I think required, implied? Probably not. I think, and I could be wrong about this. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a historian. And stay pretty close to the contemporary analytic philosophical literature. But my sense is that if the kind of view that Matthews is developing can be made to work, and I'm hopeful that it can. He's right that this is welcome news for someone in the Reformed tradition. I mean, it's just, it's more options, so to speak. But I also think that even if not necessitated or implied by kind of standard Reformed doctrine, the compatibilist view does sort of fit pretty nicely. At least the compatibilist view that I want to accept does fit pretty nicely with the Reformed doctrines. And so, unless there are any kind of clear problems, with theological or otherwise, it's sort of, for me, it's like a kind of natural starting point.
Cool. So maybe we move to just a general question. You talked about, Matthews, in your book, this idea of comprehensive determinism. So maybe we just think, why should we accept or reject it? And Taylor, both of you guys can answer that in your own ways. But I'll start with Matthews, since you wrote the book on that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, by comprehensive determinism, I would just mean every event, or at least every event and action involving, you know, creatures is determined. And I mean, the reason for rejecting it would just be if it's incompatible with freedom and moral responsibility. So, you know, if you have intuitions that moral responsibility requires that at least some of the time, you know, we do otherwise, we could have done otherwise, all prior conditions remaining the same. Determinism rules that out. And so that would be a reason to, you know, those sorts of intuitions would be a reason to reject determinism. And there's really not, I think, more there's not really much more to it than that. That would be the main reason, in my view. Yeah, I don't know. Taylor, what do you think?
Yeah, I guess the reason to accept at least a kind of theological or divine determinism is it does seem to a lot of people that if God is going to have a kind of strong providential control over everything that happens, if he's going to ordain whatsoever comes to pass, that sort of thing, it seems like, well, it is that God's something about God is explanatorily prior to everything that happens within creation. And so for that reason, I think, at least unless, you know, until they read your book and are convinced there's an alternative, it seems like, well, this is what we want, as, you know, if you've got this strong notion of providence, you want to just affirm kind of comprehensive determinism. It seems like, I mean, the other extreme of this that denies determinism whatsoever and also sort of limits God's knowledge from the perspective of kind of traditional Christian thinking about these things would be something like open theism, where, God just doesn't know everything about what will happen in the future, including how we'll freely act. And kind of by contrast, it just looks like you don't have much, if any, providential control on that kind of picture. And so if you eliminate the thing that's giving rise to, you know, if you get rid of the indeterminacy that's kind of mitigating God's providential control by just affirming determinism, it seems to solve that problem. But of course, there are intermediate notions of providence, and so I think people should consider these intermediate positions too.
And I think those theological doctrines are good reasons for accepting determinism, or at least maybe being inclined. I mean, it's sort of, all things being equal, right? And then you have to consider whether that determinism is consistent with other things you want to hold, like, you know, affirmations of freedom and moral responsibility. So that's where it gets tricky. I would agree with something that Taylor said, is, you know, these strong conceptions of providence, which I think I also want to affirm. He said that they, you know, they require that there be something, you know, in God, in a sense, that is the source of all that happens. And I want to agree with that. I mean, I want to say that's just God. I want to say God is the source and cause of all that exists apart from himself, including all creaturely actions. And so if that's right, I think it follows from that a very robust conception of God's providence. When you look at some, a thinker like Thomas Aquinas, his account of providence is pretty, it's a pretty strong conception of providence. And his arguments for providence flow from his arguments for God's universal causality. It's because God is the universal cause of all being that he also exercises providence over all being. And so I would agree with that and want to affirm it. I mean, I think there's a lot of common ground here. I think we both want to affirm that strong conception of providence, and we both want to affirm human freedom and moral responsibility. You know, and if there's a difference between us, it's just a question of whether you can do that if God's divine universal causality introduces determinism. And I'd like it to be the case that it doesn't, you know, and maybe Taylor's a little more comfortable than I am if it turns out that it does.
So our next question was fits nicely into that. You mentioned Thomas Aquinas. So first for Matthews and then Taylor, curious about what historical figures have shaped your thought on, you know, putting together these pieces of free choice determinism.
Yeah, I mean, St. Thomas would be the biggest, you know, and most important for sure, both in, you know, the picture of God as the universal cause and providential governor of all of creation is certainly there. And you find in Thomas strong conceptions of grace and predestination and all of that. But what I also found there is you find an account of divine agency there, of what God's bringing about an effect consists in, or at least strong suggestions along those lines that I think were the inspiration for the account of divine agency that I've tried to develop, which I claim in any way renders consistent God's causing an act without determining it. Now, the details of how that goes are, I mean, it gets pretty detailed, and I don't know how deep into the weeds you want to go, but it's from Thomas that I'm finding that account of divine agency that I think does the requisite work.
So just a bit of a follow-up. So you've got a footnote in your book contrasting your view with kind of the Benazian Thomist account and the notion of physical premotion. So it's an interesting, I think, ecumenically relevant question, yes. Because some early Reformed scholastics actually were influenced by Banez on this, and so there's cross-pollination. And so I'm curious. So you contrast your view with kind of the Benazian account. Do you see any other figures, like historical antecedents to this particular reading of Thomas, or is it
the one that I'm proposing? Yeah, I think so. So there's a kind of another tradition of interpretation of Thomas that I think highlights especially his views of divine transcendence, and argues that if you appreciate the difference between divine agency and divine causality and creaturely causes, and if you kind of push in that direction, then you can avoid a conflict between God's universal causality and creaturely freedom. So, and some of these thinkers, sort of explicitly reject Banez's approach, and contrast them and argue that Thomas really, what you find this idea of a physical premotion is not in Thomas, and they give a different account. So anyway, I have a recent paper, actually the paper in the volume that Taylor also published in, where I try to talk about my view in relationship to this tradition. But you find it among a lot of English Dominicans, Herbert McCabe, going back a while, and Brian Davis, and an American Dominican, Brian Shanley, Catherine Tanner, a theologian who I think is interested in Thomas and Bart and other figures. So there's a kind of a school there that I would situate my own view within. I might think my view is sort of trying to develop that tradition. I have a lot of things I would want to affirm in common with the Banezians. But it seems to me that this idea of a physical premotion does introduce a prior factor that is sort of necessitating of the creaturely action. And in that sense, it seems to me that Banezians would have to be compatibilists, whereas I want to try to make room for libertarianism.
I guess if it's the same question for me, I want to agree Thomas is an influence, Calvin and other Protestant reformers, but especially Calvin. But I think ultimately probably Augustine more than anyone. And of course, he's a huge influence on Thomas too. So there's probably some residue there. And I think Augustine himself was influenced by some of the Stoics and, of course, by the New Testament too. But I think Augustine is really original on these issues. And while there's some debate about whether his views changed over the course of his writings, I just recently taught on free choice of the will, and I've read several other things from his later anti-Pelagian writings, where there's a story to be told about how he's not really changing his views over time and has a view that sounds very close to what you see in parts of Aquinas, parts of Calvin even. So I guess those historically, those are, and then of course I already mentioned Harry Frankfurt, a lot of contemporary source compatibilists. My PhD advisor John Martin Fisher is another huge influence too, but people that are working today like them are also big influences.
So now that we have this lay of the land, I got to ask the question, Taylor, on your account, is there in any way that God can determine everything and not be the cause of sin? Like, how does that work out? I think Matthew's, that's probably an easier question for you than it is for Taylor.
Yeah, no, I think this is, other than the sort of manipulation worry for compatibilism, the worry for compatibilism plus, you know, God determining everything is this question about God being the author of sin or the cause of sin. Yeah, I do think it's this, I mean, this, I have to be careful because there are confessions that seem to say the opposite of what I'm about to say, but I do think there is a sense in which, yes, it's pretty clear that God is not only the cause of sin, but is the cause of everything that is not God. And so we have to be a little clear what we mean by saying that, you know, God is the cause of sin. I don't think that God sins. I don't think that God forces anyone to sin in a way that like makes them unfree. So what do I want to say? Ultimately, I want to say someone can be the author of sin or the cause of sin in a sense where they're not themselves culpable, blameworthy, and even can be praiseworthy for using those ordained means for some different end, some praiseworthy end. And so, yeah, I think I want to say, you know, being very careful, God in one sense is the cause of sin, but of course this is consistent with his moral perfection.
So Taylor, to follow up on that, I mean, what do you I guess maybe you would say something like the Westminster Confession of Faith is speaking in a different technical sense than what you're speaking of when you're talking about causation, because it says what, he's in no way the author or approver of sin. I would imagine they would say, they don't want to say he's the cause of sin. Is that just because they're using that terminology different than what you're using it?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the Westminster Divines were thinking. I have to think yes, because they also say that when God ordains whatsoever comes to pass, that includes sin, and also that God, I'm forgetting the exact terminology here, but doesn't undermine the freedom of creatures, but rather upholds it in causing and bringing about whatsoever comes to pass. So I have to think that they're aware of the nuances here, but of course in the confession itself, it's it just says that he's not the cause or prover of sin.
Got it. And so Matthew's, your story on this, I imagine, is pretty simple.
Yeah, well, it's actually... It's not that simple, and it does prove it is a question that is a challenge for my view. You might think of it this way, right? If I want to hold that God is the cause of all that exists apart from himself, he's the cause of all creaturely actions, some of those actions are sins, right? So it looks like it's going to follow that God is the cause of sins. I actually want to deny that he's the cause of sin, but I want to affirm something that I think sounds to a lot of people like it's contradicting the denial I just made. I want to say that he does cause the act of sin. So it's interesting. There's an article in the Summa Theologiae where Aquinas poses the question, does God cause the act of sin? And I think it would shock a lot of people to see that he answers that in the affirmative and in the most matter-of-fact way you can imagine. Of course, God is the cause of the act of sin, because he's the cause of every act. He's the cause of everything that has existence. He's the cause of every motion. So God's the cause of the act of sin. All right, fine. Next article. Is God the cause of sin? No. So he's the cause of the act of sin, but not the sin. Well, how can that be? Well, it's a bit of a long story, but he thinks that a sin of commission, that is a sin that involves an actual act on the part of the sinning agent. You might think of it as consisting both of this positive act, this positive being, and then a defect in the act. You think of like a privation account of moral evil. There's a privation in the act. You could think of it as sort of its lack of conformity to the moral standard. And Aquinas wants to say that while both God and the creature are both the cause of the act of sin, only the creature, but not God, is the cause of the defect or the privation. And so only the creature and not God is the cause of the sin itself, right? And so now defending that view against objections that might be raised, that's to say it's not super simple, because there's a lot of objections and questions that could be raised about that, that this sort of approach requires and needs an answer for. But that's what I would say.
Hey friend, are you a loyal listener to the London Lyceum? If you are, we really appreciate you. But we wanted to make sure you knew about our exclusive content option for the podcast. If you want, for just $5 a month, you can get access to all Kiffin's Keep episodes, Genuinely Particular, Typology by Immersion, and The Hanover House, and any of our other exclusive content that we produce. And all the episodes will be right there in your normal feed. So go ahead and click the link in the show description and you can sign up today. We appreciate you. So if I've heard right so far, you guys correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like everybody wants to affirm moral responsibility. Everybody wants to affirm God's providence. The question is, how do you cash out those two things and make sure you respect both of them properly? In your own, I guess, scheme of things, does one of those take priority over the other? If there's ever where you felt like truly it was 50-50, like we don't know how to solve this, is one of these going to, like, you're going to say, well, I just feel like I have stronger intuitions to say I need to protect this. This is more important.
Yeah. That's a great question. And I've wondered about that, you know, for myself, like, you know, what happens when, you know, somebody convinces me, you know, your account to try to, you know, render divine universal causality and libertarian creaturely freedom, you know, consistent, you know, that it's flawed, you know, and look around and there don't seem to be any other good ones. What are you going to do at that point? You know, retire maybe. I think it's sometimes okay to confess, you know, you're not sure which, you got a couple of things to that you want to affirm here that can't be held together, or not easy to be held together. You've got some good evidence for both of them. You're not sure which evidence is stronger. I think it can be okay just to say, I'm not really sure. I may die not knowing, mm-hmm. you know, the answer to this question. But I can still affirm that there seem to be strong reasons for, you know, both sides, and I don't see any way that they can go together, you know. So I just, you know, you have to exercise some humility sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Taylor.
I like that answer a lot. Yeah, it made me think, this is probably not the most helpful comparison, but if someone were to tell me, you know, hey, there's like no really good model of the Trinity, and you know the Trinity says that God is one, but also there are three persons, like, so you have really good reason to think that God is one, and also there's this threeness to the Trinity, which one are you going to go with if you can't find a good model of how to reconcile those things? I think I would retire. So I just know that we've got to affirm both of the things that seem like their intention. And I would say the same about both God's universal causality and also our freedom and responsibility.
So I have, go ahead, yeah. Matthew, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, I like that. I think, you know, there are views that maybe there are people, a lot of people who want to hold both of these things together, and they might emphasize one side at the expense of the other. And so they have they're interesting ways of doing it. And it may be that, yeah, if it came to it, I could live with going the compatibilist route and just, you know, and emphasizing, if it turns out that it's, you know, you can't get libertarian freedom with this kind of providence, okay, you know, maybe I can live with compatibilist freedom, or maybe I can live with a slightly less robust conception of providence, grace, and predestination than kind of the one that I'm inclined to. Mm-hmm. I think there's scriptural grounds and other sorts of grounds for wanting to affirm both of these, but you know, maybe,
yeah,
you have to give something up, but yeah, go ahead, Jordan. Sorry, you were.
I guess I can ask something. So
you had another question, yeah, I think.
As I think about the topic, and the discussion, typically it seems like free will, if you look at the vast majority of literature, it's being discussed independent of theological concerns. The discussion here has been very much centralized on theological concerns. I'm wondering, just explain this to me, like, is there a sense in which if we bracket out theology, that there is a consensus view now where maybe moral responsibility doesn't matter, or maybe it's I guess I'm not read up on all the literature. So if we just, the idea is bracket out theology, does that change the shape of the discussion in any significant way?
Taylor?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think you can look at like the Phil Paper surveys of professional philosophers to see the kind of distribution of people holding different views. And I think if you look at just contemporary philosophers, professional philosophers, that compatibilism has an edge over libertarianism, which has an edge over a kind of skeptical position. But I think I've also heard, and maybe I've done this myself, that if you look at people who also identify as theists and then look at the distribution, it changes and there might be more libertarians. So I don't know if you're totally bracketing theology. I don't know how much you want to bracket that and to ask the question, but I do think compatibilism is a very popular kind of family of views, but there's a lot of different views that fall into that camp, and there are a lot of different libertarian views too. So there's no one specific account that I think, you know, there's anything like a consensus, and nothing close to a consensus that it will work.
Yeah, that seems right. Everything which you said seems right, you know, and the point, main point being that, yeah, there's no, you, even if you take the theological stuff out, like there's a widespread disagreement, you know, among contemporary philosophers on free will issues.
A bit of a curveball, perhaps. Let's get them out of the bracket, stick them back in the middle of the discussion. We've been talking primarily about human agents. But, you know, Christians believe that humans aren't the only sorts of agents out there. So I'm curious, particularly for Taylor, does your account of freedom map globally? So this is what's required for free choice. Does that apply to angels and God? So are you a kind of a global compatibilist? So that what counts for free choice in humans also counts in God and angels? Or do you see them as kind of coming apart in any way?
Yeah, it's a good and difficult question. I do think that my account is global in that it provides sufficient conditions for being morally responsible. So that kind of free agency. Now, I didn't spell out all those conditions, but whatever my compatibilist view turns out to be, it's going to be sufficient for both angels and for God to be free. So even if God was somehow determined to act in a certain way, maybe given his nature or something along those lines, I think he could still be praiseworthy for acting in that determined way. And I think the same could go for angels, just like it does for humans. I think there are other reasons in the case of divine agency to think that God isn't determined, or at the very least that his that the act of creation is not something that God sort of couldn't have avoided, because I don't want to say that in any sense that God had to create us or this the world as he did, or that God had to create it all. I don't want to go the sort of Leibniz route and say, you know, God had to create this world, maybe because of considerations having to do with rationality or anything along those lines. So I guess I'm tempted to think that we should think God's there's some kind of indeterminacy in divine agency that may not apply in the case of created beings. But this is me very much out of my depth. I'm not really ultimately sure what I want to say.
And I would want to agree that I think there are reasons to deny that God had to create this particular world, or really any world. I think though he created this world, he could have done otherwise. That's what I would want to say. So I don't know what
so Taylor, I was just going to push on you a little bit. Do you feel ahead, like Jordan. That puts a significant inconsistency in how you think about free will, if you want to introduce indeterminacy there? Or is it just like, I don't know what to do with it, so I'm going to be okay with it?
Yeah, it's not quite that bad, and it's not quite ad hoc like that might suggest. I mean, I hope it isn't, because what I want to say is there's something different about God from us, and it's going to have to do with the fact that God is the transcendent creator. And so I think it's fitting that there be this indeterminacy at that level that's not required for moral agency or for moral responsibility and that sort of thing. It's not that I think that, like, for God, if I were forced to say, oh, well, for God to be, like, praiseworthy for what he does, he has to have, like, been able to do something inferior or sin or something like that, then I think I'd be running into a problem, because why wouldn't the same sort of thing apply to moral agents like us? But I think it really does have to do with this idea, which I think is really coming from theological considerations, that that God's free decision and free to create, and that his freely creating the world, is a kind of grace. It's not the sort of thing that he had to do in any sense. And so, but that's different from him being praiseworthy for it, which I also want to affirm.
Yeah. I don't know, Taylor, you know, to explore a little bit of some of the reasons for this, but for me, one of them is kind of wrapped up in ideas of God's lack of finitude. You know, it seemed like if God's nature were such that he had to, as it were, you know, create this particular world, it seems like that's a limited nature, right? You can imagine, you know, you certainly can conceive of a nature that would create a different world, or be, you know, so it gives God a kind of limited definition in what his powers are, that seems to be in conflict with his lack of finitude, which seems to then suggest, you know, be in conflict with his divine simplicity, which I'm a fan of, and so I would, you know, want to avoid that. And yeah, so anyway,
you, Matthews, you introduced divine simplicity, so now I have to ask. I feel like a common argument against divine simplicity that I've seen in recent literature is to say that if you affirm it, then you have a modal collapse where everything does become necessary. Is that a worry we should have if we want to affirm divine simplicity? Because it seems on the face of it like the idea is plausible, and it's plausible enough that it seems like a lot of people find that as a reason to reject divine simplicity. So I'd love to hear a little bit there on that. I don't know, Taylor, if you have thoughts on that. I don't think you've done a lot of work on divine simplicity, so I'm not going to put you on the spot for it, but
I haven't much, and I'd be curious to hear what Matthews thinks about modal collapse worry.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff on divine simplicity is actually related to my stuff on divine agency and its relationship to freedom, because the particular way of understanding God's agency is in part motivated by divine simplicity. It seems to be the best way of understanding God's agency that is consistent with divine simplicity. But just to get to divine simplicity itself, I mean, I think some think, well, if you want to understand, if you want to think about God's action as being contingent, you know, something that God does but he might not have, then you're going to have to say that God has some sort of accidental property, that his act of creating this world is some accidental property that God has that he would lack in some other possible world where he doesn't create. Objection, among other things, it presupposes that God's act of creating is some sort of intrinsic property of God, whereas I would want to say that it's extrinsic, that Aquinas will ask, you know, what creation is sometimes, and he'll say creation is the, you know, the creature or the relation of dependence that the creature has on God, that's what creation is. So this idea of an action of an agent's bringing something about is actually being extrinsic to that agent. Aristotle seemed to think that this was true of not just of God, but of agent causes in general. So when fire brings about heat and water, the fire's act of bringing about the heat is not some property in the fire. It's actually the heat with its relation of dependence back on the fire. And so, I think there are even sort of non-theological precedent for this extrinsic understanding of agency that then when you apply to God, can help solve the modal collapse issues. There are others who have argued, Christopher Tomaszewski, that apart from this special conception of God's agency, that the modal collapse arguments are actually invalid, that they violate. So I think there are problems with the modal collapse arguments that I've seen.
Cool. Now I want to give everybody a last chance. So Joel, if you have any burning questions you want to ask them. And if not, then I want to let Taylor and Matthews both give any sort of closing comments on the discussion, the debate, maybe advice for those who are thinking about it, those sort of things.
I'm good. This was great.
So Taylor, I'll let you start.
I guess I don't really have anything more to say about my view. I guess I just want to express appreciation for Matthews's work, because for me, I do see it as a sort of a positive development, even as a committed compatibilist. If someone can be a libertarian and can say everything that Matthews wants to say, that they come closer to me than even, you know, someone who's in between, you know, my view of providence and an open theist, like someone like a Molinist, I think. And so, I sort of am appreciative of work at exactly this point, where it's like, you know, for someone with Reformed convictions who's not totally sure about compatibilism or not, there's this other kind of view out there that now on the table. So I just wanted to end with a kind of an appreciative remark.
Thanks. I appreciate that, Taylor. And I had a question for you that I wanted to insert various points, but didn't. The conversation moved on. But I was just curious, in terms of your own compatibilist views, like, is it, how much of it was driven by theological convictions? Like, did you first have the theological convictions and then come to a more broader compatibilism that applies to, you know, the terrestrial realm as well, or did the other go the other way?
I guess, sort of genealogically, the theological views did come first, because I had them before I started really doing philosophy and really understanding the kind of contemporary free will debate. But I don't think I was sort of like looking for which view of which view in the contemporary landscape my theological views sort of mapped onto best. I guess. I don't think I could have entirely bracketed my own convictions, but I think I was just looking at the options and the pros and cons of each and that sort of thing. So I think maybe a little bit of both, but definitely I would be dishonest to say that sort of it was all philosophy and then it just happened to align with the theological convictions that I have.
Yeah.
Now I do. So you guys mentioned something that I have to ask about Molinism. Where does Molinism fit in this discussion at all? I know that's a huge can of worms, so you don't Sorry, feel like you bad. Have to do it, but I want to know, like, where does that fit? Is that like, Matthews, is that close to what you're trying to do? Is that far away from it? Like, give me some help with where it goes.
Yeah. So I think Molinism is an attempt to get you a very strong, robust conception of providence alongside libertarian freedom. And in that respect, it sounds similar to the sort of thing that I'm trying to do. But in fact, I think it's a weaker conception of providence than what I want to affirm in of my account, if it works, gives you. For one thing, for the Molinists, like, I guess I want to say, you know, I want a conception of providence and sovereignty that says, like, that whatever is any possible state of affairs God could bring about. And I think the Molinists can't say that, because the Molinist thinks that there's certain truths about what possible free creatures would do in any set of circumstances that are true prior to any creative act on God's part. So if God knows from all eternity that if you invited Taylor to come on this program, that he would come on, he would agree to come on. Even though it's actually sort of metaphysically possible that Taylor not come on, it wasn't within God's power to bring about a world in which Taylor did not come accept the invitation. And that seems to me a pretty serious limitation, both on traditional conceptions of God's omnipotence and on traditional conceptions of God's sovereignty and providence. And so I think Taylor would want to say, no, God can bring about, you know, it's up to God in a sense, for any possibility, whether that possibility sees the light of actuality. I don't know.
Joel, you look like you have a question.
It takes too far afield, but yeah.
But I mean, Molinism is a lot closer to, I think, the sort of view theological views we're inclined to. It's a lot closer than, say, open theism, which has a significantly weaker conception of providence and sovereignty, and a weaker, you know, certain, you know, typically rejects God's knowledge of the future as well. I do think, though, there may be degrees of sovereignty within open theism too, depending on exactly what you want to say when pressed on certain detailed questions.
Cool. Yeah. Well, Joel, I do want to let you have a last word if you want before we wrap up.
Only if I can kick him one more question for both of them.
You kick another question away.
So, you know, most of the listeners to London Lyceum are seminarians, pastors, theologically invested laity, who are, you know, they're probably interested in philosophical questions. If they're not, they're probably not still listening. But mostly, you know, it's really the theological concerns that are animating them. So with that audience in mind, I'm curious if, from both of you, do you have kind of like a recommended resource for, someone who's interested in these questions, these discussions, go check this out if you want to learn more. Now, obviously, Taylor's got an excellent podcast, so he's got an easy out on that one. But yeah, just resources for that particular audience.
Well, thanks for mentioning that I have a podcast. I wasn't going to plug it, but thanks. I also wrote a piece for the London Lyceum. It's on the Ledger, recommending five books, kind of just introducing the contemporary philosophical landscape. There's a short introduction to free will by Megan Griffith that I've used in my teaching and that I've learned a lot from. I think that's fantastic. There's also Peter Van Inwagen's sort of classic, An Essay on Free Will. But that probably for the audience that you're thinking of, that might be too much. The Megan Griffith book. And then there are a lot of things by Christian philosophers that are really good. I'll just mention the book. I'll hold it up for anyone that's watching on YouTube. But the book that Matthew's mentioned that he and I both have chapters in that Peter Furlong and Lee Vincennes edited, called Theological Determinism, New Perspectives. It came out last year with Cambridge, and it has chapters by people kind of all over the spectrum of positions in these debates. But it could be, you know, especially if you wanted to cherry pick here and there, it could be interesting, to seminarians and pastors and even lay folks.
Yeah, those are all good. Yeah. I think, I don't know, going back to, like, you were mentioning Augustine, I mean, and maybe these folks are already reading or have read Augustine, but, I mean, I think going back and seeing the sorts of things he says, and, you know, especially in engaging the Pelagians, and the scripture that he's drawing from, and thinking a little bit about why all that's important, you know, for the Christian moral and spiritual life, I think that's as good a place to start as any too, you know, if you want to go back to some older stuff, much older.
Well, that's awesome. And as you all know, I like to make fun of Joel. So we had recently, we did an episode with his friends Tom McCall and Keith Stanglin on Arminianism, and we got our first ever one-star review because we hosted Arminians on our podcast and let them confuse people with definitions.
So now you have one co-host.
Yes, so now I'm imagining if you're watching right now, you're hitting the dislike button. So more power to you. Though if you're cool, you'll hit the like button as you watch it, and then hit the subscribe little bell or whatever it is. So thanks everybody for tuning in. This is a lot of fun for us, but I also, like, I always want to remind you, support our guests and their work. So Taylor, I know you have a website. Matthews, I don't remember if you have a website. Do you have a website? Okay.
I don't. Maybe I should get one at some point, but yeah, I don't have one. But my book is probably the place to go for, you know, if you wanted really detailed argumentation to support the sort of views I was describing, that's the best place to find it. So it's just called Free Will and God's Universal Causality, the Dual Sources
Awesome.
Account.
So if you're watching this or listening to this, I'll put this in the description or the notes wherever you listen at, so that you can click it and go right there and get a copy of it and support them in their work and what they're doing, because I love having people on who not only are very smart but also have the right attitude and disposition to discuss these sort of things. And I think you can tell that both Taylor and Matthews exhibit that and have that. So thanks for what you guys are doing and your areas of research. It's really helpful and encouraging. So everybody's been tuning in. This is the only Analytic Baptist and Confessional podcast on the planet. And we thanks for you watching or listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.